speaking of St. Louis. When I attended our Unitarian Universalist Association's General Assembly there a couple summers ago, summer before last, I had one ulterior motive. I allow myself one ulterior motive per GA whenever I go to attend one. This time around, it was to find and photograph the childhood and adolescent home of William S. Burroughs. The address I had was 4664 Pershing Avenue. I got a hold of a card and a street map of St. Louis, a city I had never visited before, and set out on my quest. As I followed my map to my destination, I noticed that I was moving into one of the toniest, probably most upscale sections of the city. And when I got to the point, where Pershing Avenue intersected the street that I was on, I encountered a big iron closed gate. I swear, Pershing Avenue was a gated street. So I parked the car on the street that I was already on and headed on foot up Pershing, which to its credit, I guess, did have an accessible sidewalk, and I moved along. It was a beautiful Midwestern June day, and I walked past these big, old, beautiful houses that were all somewhat well back from the street. Most of them were being beautifully tended to. The lawns were being beautifully tended to by gardeners and landscapers. I eventually got to the address. I found what had been the Burroughs home and somewhat audaciously walked up its front walk close enough to get a good picture or two. And then I figured I had better get myself out of that neighborhood where my very casual attire alone was probably driving down the property values. I also did notice that the other end of Pershing was open to traffic, but I was just as glad that I had walked it because it gave me a good feel for the early home environment of the Beat Generation writer and combination genius and misfit, William Burroughs. Just a side note here, when William's parents purchased their home before William was born, the street was then called Berlin Avenue. With the coming of World War I and with Germany being the enemy, I guess the powers that be or were in St. Louis decided that a street named Berlin wouldn't do, so they renamed it after General Pershing. Well, walking back to my car, though, I couldn't help but compare the street and the home where I'd just seen with the working-class neighborhood double-decker down at number 9 Lupine Road in Lowell's Centerville section where Jack Kerouac was born 86 years ago, this coming Wednesday, just so you know. Actually, you're going to help with the birthday celebration today. I was down in Lowell last night for a birthday event that I helped produce and put on, and we had a nice birthday cake, and some of it was left over, so I brought it back up here for coffee hour today, so you get a little Kerouac birthday cake during coffee hour. It was the meeting up of Kerouac, Burroughs, and Allen Ginsberg in New York City as World War II was drawing to a close that is generally heralded as the birth of the Beat Generation. I know Beat scholars like to argue that point, but I don't have the time, and I doubt you have the interest for the finer nuances of Beatology today, so I'm just going to leave it at that. But it was these three persons from quite radically different socioeconomic and cultural and religious backgrounds that really helped give rise to a genre of literature and poetry that has now come to be recognized as one of the major literary and cultural expressions of post-World War II America and beyond. Some of you may know I got my own book out on this whole subject about 3 years ago, where I treat the Beat movement as a primarily religious and spiritual phenomenon. I figure since I wrote most of that book while I was on a sabbatical, for which you fine people were, paying, I figured maybe I'd bring a little bit of sermon out of it once in a while so you can get an idea of what I was doing, which gets us to where we are right now. I have created a personal tradition for myself in my ministry here, which I guess you're just going to have to indulge me in, whereby I use the Sunday closest to Jack Kerouac's birthday of March 12th to speak to the life and literary legacy of one of the Beat Generation writers. Well, this year I decided to really fly without a net and go with the oddest odd duck of them all, who was William Burroughs of St. Louis, Missouri, and many other parts of the globe over his 83 years of living. I figured this sermon definitely belongs in the category of what was I thinking when I thought of this, but we'll see where it goes. And as I was driving down here this morning, I got to thinking, I wonder if there has ever been a sermon on William Burroughs delivered from a UU pulpit before. Anyway, in which case I decided this could be an historic first, if not an historic last. Well, the best image or metaphor that I could offer for both the life and the writing of Bill Burroughs would be a Jackson Pollock painting, or an impressionistic or surrealistic work of art, with splotches of images thrown all over the place in a way that jars your senses even as you try to make some kind of sense out of it. Just the geography of his life is enough to make your head spin. His pastiche of a life itinerary went something like this. Early years in St. Louis, boarding school in Los Alamos, New Mexico, Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he graduated from Harvard with a degree in English literature, a brief hitch in the Army in Europe during World War II, then back to Chicago, back to St. Louis, then to New York, then to the hamlet of Far Texas, where he tried his hand at farming, then to New Orleans, to Mexico City, to Tangier, Algeria, with short side residences in London and Paris, then back to New York for a spell in the 1970s and 1980s, before living out his final years in Lawrence, Kansas. I also figured if you were to consider this man's life from, let's say, the perspective of a parent, I would have to say, with apologies to Willie Nelson, mamas, don't let your babies grow up to be Burroughs. And Mr. Burroughs, I am sure, would wholeheartedly concur. He never offered his life as any kind of example of healthy and wholesome living to anyone. He just wanted to live completely on his own terms, both for better and for worse, and throughout his life, he got his share of both. What gets my attention about it, however, and I have to say I can only take his madcap and often deliberately disjointed writings in certain measured doses, but what hooks me about him is what he reports back from his view into an abyss of humanity's seamier side, an unblinking view of a world seen from the dead end, rock bottom up, and a view sometimes seen through the horrifying experiences of narcotics addiction, which Burroughs battled off and on throughout his life. His first published work, in fact, was a novel called Junkie, which is a completely unvarnished, a completely de-romanticized view of drug addiction. But his vision was also one that still held out for the possibility of some kind of transcendent, some kind of redeeming meaning to it all. I'll come back to that point a little later. His was also the view of a trenchant satirist. He kind of wrote in the tradition of Jonathan Swift, very trenchant satirist of Britain, who's, I don't have time to get into it, but his essay, A Modest Proposal, kind of precursed Burroughs in some ways. But here's a quick example of how Burroughs could find a bizarre, an off-the-wall kind of humor in the most unhumorous of situations and settings. Shortly after he and Kerouac first met in New York, they decided to collaborate on a detective novel in which they would each write successive chapters. So like Burroughs would write a chapter, then Jack would write a chapter, and kind of back and forth. Well, in the course of doing this, while they were working on it, they were listening to a radio broadcast about a terrible fire in a London zoo that killed a number of the animals. And the last line of the broadcast, which the announcer just kind of read off this copy sheet he must have had before moving on to the next item, the last line of the broadcast, the announcer goes, "And the hippos were boiled in their tanks." And then he goes on to the next news item, like that was the last thing he said. Well, Burroughs immediately decided that that line, which had absolutely nothing to do with anything they were writing about, would be the title of their novel. So they called the novel, "The Hippos Were Boiled in Their Tanks." The book, to the extent that it even got written, was never published. And much later in his life, in this flat, dry wit, twangy Midwestern voice that became his trademark, and I can't do a Burroughs very well, but he said something like, It was not a particularly distinguished piece of work. His diction, in fact, was kind of a Midwestern version of a very recently departed William F. Buckley. Well, back to another take on his life. Burroughs was born to privilege, but he chose to spend much of his life with society's outcasts and discards. In this one respect, at least, his life was kind of like that of Siddhartha Buddha. Probably the only respect that was like Buddha's, but turned his back on this life of wealth and privilege, kind of go live with the down and out people. In fact, the song we heard there, St. Louis Blues, says it pretty well. Burroughs turned his back on St. Louis's upper crust to live with those whose lives were, in one way or another, defined by the blues. William's father, for whom he was named, invented the Burroughs adding machine in the 1890s, which gave rise to the Burroughs Adding Machine Company, which gave rise to the Burroughs Corporation, which many decades later morphed into one of the eight largest computer companies in America for a time. The Burroughs family, however, cashed in on only a fraction of the immense wealth of this company in time garnered. For William's father sold his share of the company as the Depression approached, so his family could continue to live in the style to which they were accustomed. That worked well enough in the short run. It also meant that the Burroughs heirs completely missed out on the enormous wealth that the Burroughs Corporation eventually generated. But even with his father's, short-term or short-sighted move, William was able to live as vagabond out on the fringes life to at least some degree off a family trust fund that was set up for him and which gave him a modest income. It was only in his later years that he was able to live off of his writings and public appearances, which in 1981, at the age of 87, included a guest appearance on Saturday Night Live. Don't know if anybody caught it or not, but he did run on Saturday Night Live. Well, if every writer or artist has his defining moment, Burroughs had one that was writ large, big time. While he lived most of his life as an openly gay man, he was married for a time to Joan Palmer Adams Burroughs, with whom they had a son. She was a woman who was part of the original Beat Circle in New York in the 1940s. And their marriage ended in a very tragic and terribly insane way when William accidentally shot and killed her in September of 1951 in Mexico City, when they were living there. With a few other friends present, this is part of the beaten lore. You never know quite how much of the story is true and how much is not, except that poor Joan ended up dead. But with a few other friends present, and with their minds in, shall we say, an altered state, Joan placed a glass on top of her head and supposedly said, okay, it's time for our William Tell act. They didn't have a William Tell act. And she dared William to shoot it off with a loaded pistol that was also in the room. William took the dare. He aimed too low. And you can guess the rest. With the services of a good lawyer, paid for by the family trust, who was able to convince the judge, correctly actually, that Joan was the victim of a deadly and horribly irresponsible accident, Bill did a very minimal jail sentence and was on his way. Much later in his life, Burroughs would write of his experience in this way. The death of Joan brought me into contact with the invader, the ugly spirit, and maneuvered me into a lifelong struggle in which I had no choice but to write my way out. While some of his zany satirical pieces do manage to hook me, I can't say that I enjoy reading Burroughs all that much. When it comes to his signature work, Naked Lunch, I can only take it in the measured doses to which I referred earlier. I would much rather just cruise along with Kerouac in On the Road or The Dharma Bounds. But I still find I am drawn, nonetheless, to someone who used his writing as a means of trying to save himself or exorcise himself from a personal invasion of what he called the ugly spirit. Take it in toto, take it in the whole thing. Burroughs' body of work is a kind of literary exorcism. And if you read them, that's kind of what you're being invited to. So I would like to offer just a couple of the dimensions of Burroughs' writings that have helped to inform kind of my own flight journey here. Occasionally, I teach a class on the literature of the Beat Movement down at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, which, and when we do Burroughs, I've got several hours worth of class time to kind of work on them. That's not what we're dealing with here, so I'm going to have to greatly economize. One of Burroughs' recurring themes has to do with the use of language and the power of the word when it comes to understanding and grasping what is true and what is reliable. Burroughs, as a writer, understood and respected and relied upon the power of the word. As one myself who, in part, makes a living by the shaping of language, I certainly do as well. The verse in the opening chapter of the Gospel of John, "In the beginning was the Word." If you read that from, say, a Burgosian point of view, it means that the beginning of language was the true dawn of humanity. But for Burroughs, the word was also a virus. One of his recurring themes, the word virus. The word was a virus. By that he meant it was an instrument of mind control and manipulation in the hands of the powerful. William didn't live long enough to see the Patriot Act enacted. But he would have, in a very perverse way, loved it. Loved it, that is, as an example of the manipulation of language, whereby questioning any of its privileges, any one of its provisions, allows those who are enacting it to call those who question it enemies of the state. Word virus indeed. So what Burroughs was trying to do in some of his more out there novels was to put on paper what a surrealistic artist puts on a canvas, which is to say a bunch of scrambled and sometimes shocking images that deliberately strain and test the senses of the viewer or the reader. What he's trying to do is scramble your senses, so you then have to put your senses back together on your own terms. So if you're really not up to having your senses scrambled, then I'd say stay away from the guy, particularly when it comes to a book like Naked Lunch or another book he titled The Ticket That Exploded. But Burroughs did have a purpose. He did have a method to his madness, which was to counter the word virus and to make his readers actually think about what they're being asked to swallow when it's all right out there on the end of your fork, which is where he got the title, Naked Lunch. One more of the many angles on his work that I'm going to hold up has to do with, believe it or not, Burroughs' search for God. Now, shortly before his death, which was in 1997, William gave his last major interview to Rolling Stone magazine, in which he said, among other things, "I've always believed in God. I don't think anyone could read my books and believe otherwise." I came across that, and of all the startling things that Burroughs ever said or wrote, I have to say, that was the line that startled me the most. I haven't read all of this stuff, but a good deal of it. And I'd be damned if I can find anything about God anywhere in it at all. But then I kind of took that and I linked back to something that the recently departed Norman Mailer said about the guy. When his book Naked Lunch was first published, it had to go through the ritual of an obscenity trial, kind of like Allen Ginsberg's Howl also did, before it could be widely distributed. So he has this trial, and Norman Mailer testifies on his behalf, and here's part of what Mailer said. "William Burroughs, in my opinion, is, in my opinion, a religious writer. There's a sense in Naked Lunch of the destruction of the soul. It is a vision of how mankind would act, totally divorced from eternity." Well, he set aside the gender-specific language there, taking into account this trial took place in the early 1960s, and I think Mailer was onto something. Because by eternity, the word eternity, he doesn't mean time going on forever. Life divorced from any sense of eternity, as I believe Mailer was talking about, means life lived apart from, divorced from, any kind of a larger, transcendent, holistic meaning of what life is finally all about. Life, that is to say, devoid of any ultimate meaning or purpose. All right, now to pull in the late Paul Tillich to this thing, who I consider to be one of the premier theologians of the 20th century. Tillich held that the word God did not refer to a willful and supernatural supreme being, but refers instead to that which gives life its ultimate meaning and purpose above and beyond the many penultimate or less than ultimate meanings, both for good and for ill, that we build our lives around. So viewed in this way, much of Burroughs' work, or if you take Tillich's definition, much of Burroughs' work is about the absence of God. Not God in any authoritarian or controlling sense, because another one of Burroughs' themes I really didn't have that much time to get into, is a lifelong railing against practically all forms of authority and control. To the extent that Burroughs had a political philosophy, it was a very radical kind of libertarianism with a pretty good dash of anarchy thrown in. So what he means, though, when he writes about the absence of God, he means the absence of any transcendent meaning to life itself. But remember, he said he actually believed in God. So he must have been holding out in the midst of all this madness he was portraying, for at least the possibility of an affirming and transcendent meaning, even as he took his readers on a journey to a harrowing, frightening, revolting, and at times insanely hilarious world, where, in Mailer's apt words, the reader witnesses the destruction of the soul. All right. I'm going to see if for the next few minutes I can get any of this down to where most of us actually live. I'm guessing that whatever our trials and tribulations have been, I know we all have them, most of us do not experience life as an ongoing struggle with the ugly spirit. I'm further guessing that none of us shot a spouse at some earlier point in our lives. No, okay, just check. And while the phrase destruction of the soul may be a little over the top in describing our own journeys of the spirit, I'm also going to guess that most of us have had our own dark nights of the soul, times when we found our spirits diminished, times when we've had our own encounters with meaninglessness. We do look for ways to reach beyond the various and sundry banalities that sometimes seem to engulf us. Indeed, I feel it was this very human need for some sense of transcendence in our lives, for some sense that we're a part of a reality greater than ourselves, however we may name it. That is ultimately what has given rise to religions and religious communities and spiritual pursuits and ventures of many kinds. And for myself, I became a Unitarian Universalist for essentially the same both personal and professional reasons. I did it so I could be a part of a community, as well as seek to try to offer some leadership to a community where a variety of paths to the transcendent are honored and affirmed without being tied to a single doctrine. Most religions, the route to the transcendent is you got to go, this is the road you got to take. I wanted a route to the transcendent, but I wanted a community where there was more than one possibility. A place where differing roads can be taken to the greater force, the greater presence, the greater power, the greater reality in which our lives are ultimately grounded. And this is the kind of community that we are all to be co-creators here in making happen. However broken or whole the lives that come into our midst may be, however broken or whole any of our lives may be at one point, it is here that we continue to offer those paths to the transcendent. Burroughs said that the role of the writer, or the poet, or the artist was to let people know what they already know about their lives so they can see themselves anew. And I think that describes one of our callings as a liberal religious community here. I hope we can continue to be about it. By most indications, Bill Burroughs did find some measure of peace in his later years, after his quite chaotic life. When he returned to America in the late 1970s, a man named James Greerholtz came into his life. He was several decades Williams Jr. And James became Williams' business manager, companion, and partner. Not surprisingly, Burroughs had little clue as to how to organize a professional life for himself. But James did. And it was Mr. Greerholtz that got Burroughs his good publishing and his recording deals, negotiated his public appearances. And it was Greerholtz who made Burroughs, for a time, something of a celebrity with the punk rock crowd. In fact, Burroughs' profile in the 1980s and into the 1990s was as a performer, so to speak, at various punk rock clubs like CBGB's in New York or other places like that. He would come in dressed in a three-piece suit. One of the many ways he was offbeat was he was even offbeat to the beats. He liked to go around dressed kind of like I am right here. He would come into these clubs dressed in a three-piece suit, sit behind a table, read from his works, and bring down the house. And in 1982, he was inducted into the American Academy and Institute of Arts and Letters, which represented an embrace by the very literary establishment that had shunned him for most of his life. Well, James Greerholtz is from Lawrence, Kansas, still lives in Lawrence, Kansas, which is the home of the University of Kansas. And when the New York scene and the road got to be too much for William, he and James bought themselves a modest little house on a modest little street in Lawrence, one state over from Burroughs' native Missouri. And there, William Seward Burroughs lived out his days. He died in August of 1997, a few short months after one of his lifelong soulmates, Allen Ginsberg, also passed away. Burroughs' last major published work was called The Western Lands, and it ends on this poignant autobiographical note. The old writer couldn't write anymore because he had reached the end of words, the end of what could be done with words. What then? In Tangier, the parade part is closed. Shadows are falling on the mountain. Hurry up, please. It's time. Whoever or whatever Burroughs took God to be, in his case, he felt he could not gain the blessings of the Holy Spirit without first facing down the ugly spirit. But however much of a journey an artist, a poet, or a writer may take through the dark side, their ultimate objective is to shed greater light on themselves, to shed greater light on those who come in touch with their work, and allow those who come in touch with their work to shed greater light upon themselves. Perhaps their search for the growing light can be of help in us finding ours. And that's the closing hymn that we will sing about, With Joy We Claim the Growing Light. Let's sing that together.